So I guess I want to talk about three things rather briefly. To an outsider, one of the interesting things about general relativity is that Einstein and contemporary physicists seem to talk about events. And it's not clear what an event is. I mean, it is certainly something like, at this time, there is a particle at this point. I mean, if there's anything that an event is, it's that. All right, so I want first to talk about reductionism very briefly. And I want to say that reductionism fails, and I think that that may be important to our discussion because it may have to do with when and where laws are emergent and evolve with time. So that's the background for why I'm saying what I'm saying. Take the heart. Now, if you ask for the function of the heart, and you ask Charles Darwin, he would say the function of the heart is to pump blood. And if he pointed out that the heart does other things, like it makes heart sounds, he would say that that's not the function of the heart. And he would then appeal to natural selection over millions of years from some pharyngeal muscle that had rhythmic contractions in an early worm to us as a story of the heart. This has a very important consequence because it says that the function of the heart is a subset of its causal consequences. Not everything that the heart does, it's the function of the heart. It's a subset of its causal consequences. The statement happens to be true. The function of the heart is to pump blood. Now, suppose that a physicist were to come along and give a complete accounting of the human organism, all of the parts and all the molecules and all of the thises and all of the thats. Let's conceive that the physicist could give an accounting of the complete causal consequences of all of the bits and pieces of everything in the organism. The physicist, as a physicist, would have no way to pick out the causal consequences, the function of the heart, from all of its other causal consequences. To do so, he has to appeal to the notion of an organism in an environment and niches and natural selection and all of the stuff that Darwin appealed to. And it's precisely in this sense that I think reductionism fails. You can't get to the categories of physical, you can't get to the categories of biological description without playing the biologist's language game, if I can use a Wittgensteinian term to put it in its weakest form. But I think it's ontologically important too. So I think reductionism doesn't go all the way through. The second thing that I want to say is speaks to this question of the space of configurations. One of the things that's striking about general relativity and quantum mechanics and Newtonian mechanics and statistical mechanics is that you begin by stating what the configuration space is. Then you have the particles and the laws and the initial and the boundary conditions, and you calculate the way Newton taught us how to do. To talk about this, and it may be related to what Maya just said with respect to mathematical systems that don't seem to be predictable.
Well, you can't decide whether they're predictable or not, which is much more profound. Actually.
Right, I agree. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. So I'm going to make a statement about the biological world, and it has to do with what Darwin called pre-adaptations. So here's the idea. A causal consequence of your heart is that it makes heart sounds. So I'm going to tell a funny little story in which Lee is the hero to describe, and Lee knows the story. Jaron. So Jaron has... So here's Darwin's idea. There could be a part of an organism that has a causal consequence that is of no selective significance in the current environment, but in a funny, different environment that may turn out to be useful and hence be selected. And that's called a pre-adaptation, or by Steve Gould, an exaptation. So let's take Jaron, and let me tell my story because it makes it clear and you'll remember the story when you don't remember the words. So Jaron has a single Mendelian dominant mutant in his heart. The heart's a resonant chamber, and Jaron's mutant heart makes his heart able to pick up earthquake pre-tremors. And he's in Los Angeles, and he feels something in his heart and says, oh my goodness gracious, it's an earthquake. And he runs out into an open field, and the earthquake comes, and millions of people are killed, and Jaron's fine because no chasm opens under him. And pretty soon he's famous throughout all of Los Angeles. And pretty soon word reaches New York, and he's invited to get on to Good Morning America. And he's on Good Morning America, and he becomes famous. And, you know, women are stunned that Jerry has this mutant heart, and they flock to his side. And he meets with me. There has to be a guy who plays this role.
And pretty soon there's... for a woman to play the role. Yeah.
No, it won't work, because you've got to have lots of kids. Yeah, you've got to have thousands of kids. That's hard for a woman to do. So Jaron has thousands of offspring after an exhausting week.
It's such a shame that Lena just left.
She also became community ways. You know that. Yeah.
So all of Jaron's kids, boys and girls alike, have the same single Mendelian mutant heart. So they can pick up earthquake pre-tremors. And now if we imagine that earthquakes happened often enough that that was of selective significance, pretty soon there'd be earthquake detectors in the biosphere. To our knowledge, there are not now. So that's a Darwinian pre-adaptation. Now, let me next tell you that Darwinian pre-adaptations actually occur. For example, your lungs derive from the swim.
The pre-adaptation is that there would be or that there are not? That there would be such detectors in everybody, or the fact that
Jaron's kids are really good at picking up earthquakes. Mm. So let's imagine that earthquakes happen often enough so that it's of selective significance. Then pretty soon they would be selected for.
Sure.
And so then there'd be earthquake detectors in the biosphere.
Yeah.
Okay. So no, that's
just a point of language. The pre-adaptation was Jaron's, the mutation for Jaron's heart before the earthquake.
Right.
So pre-adaptations actually occur in biology. For example, your heart, not your heart, your lungs derive from the swim bladder of a fish. And the swim bladder of the fish was there to regulate where in the water column the fish was at neutral buoyancy. But here's this sac that has air and water in it. It's sort of pre-adapted for getting air in and absorbing oxygen across the boundaries. So that's how we have lung. Now, I'm going to say something I believe to be true, and I've never found anybody who disagreed with me, but I don't know how to prove that it's true. And the question is the following. Do you think you could say ahead of time what all possible Darwinian pre-adaptations are, say for organisms living now, or more restrictedly, say for human beings? And I think everybody agrees with what Robert is doing. You shake your head and say no. Okay. Now, I don't know the status of the statement. First of all, I don't know if it's true or false, but I believe it to be true. Second, I don't know if I made a mathematical statement.
You can state or you cannot
state? I cannot.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if I've just made an empirical statement or a mathematical statement. I don't know if it's just the complexity of the calculational task and it's transcomputational. I don't know. But in any case, we can't. No, that isn't stopping the biosphere at all. The biosphere is evolving via pre-adaptations all the time. And it means something radical. I'm going to say it in its most radical way, then I'm going to back down from it. In the most radical way, it means that we cannot say ahead of time, we cannot finitely pre-state the configuration space of the biosphere. We cannot say the things that will come to exist beforehand. And this is radically at odds with everything we've been taught since Newton about how to do things. Because you know ahead of time what the possibilities are for Newton and for Schrodinger and for Einstein and for Boltzmann. Okay? We don't. Let alone in social theory, Roberto. So we are cut free from the pattern of reasoning that we've used and we're adrift. For example, in this world, the probability the frequency interpretation of probability doesn't help you, okay? Because in the frequency interpretation of probability, you know ahead of time what all possible configurations of heads and tails are, and then you do the probability calculus and you come up with your frequency interpretation. Can't do that for the biosphere. Now let me back down a little bit. Suppose that a classical physicist were to say, but look, this is just a 6n-dimensional phase space. Mm-hmm. Out to, say, twice the radius of the moon. And so that's the configuration space of the biosphere, and what are you talking about? To which I will respond by saying, Mr. Physicist, what you cannot do in this case, even if you can pre-state the configuration space of the biaser as your classical 6n-dimensional spaces, you cannot talk about a collective set of variables called an earthquake detector. There's no way to pick out the collective variables that will come to matter in the actual physical evolution of the biosphere. And here I think that what I've said is unassailable. The physicists can't say that. Okay? None of us can say it. Okay? So if I give up on the claim...
You mean with a reductionist approach?
Yeah. And without playing the biologist, even playing the biologist's game, we can't say that earthquake detectors are going to come to exist in the biosphere. And it's not that it breaks any physical law. It's that we didn't have the dampest idea about earthquake detectors before they arose, okay? And we had no way to predict it. So I think there's a radical difficulty with predicting things. Now, Lee and I then wrote a paper, because I persuaded Lee of this point of view, in which we wondered about whether or not in general relativity this bears on the question of time, because in general relativity, it's just a geometrical object called a line in space-time. And Lee can report on that more adequately than I can, but what we wanted to say was, if you cannot pre-state the configuration space, you cannot even get started on Einstein's adventure. So, okay, so that's point number two. Point number three, so now we've talked about the incapacity to reduce biology to physics. Not that biology is breaking any laws, it's that it's emergent. Then I've now talked about the fact that we cannot pre-state what biology is going to go do. And we can't. Okay? Now what I want to do is say that part of what it does is it invents new, I'm either going to say laws or law-like properties that themselves govern the future evolution of the biosphere. And I'll just restrict myself to the example I've already given you because it makes the point. So think about the evolution of the sexual apparatus. It's very complicated. It includes mitosis, it includes meiosis, it includes the pairings of mom's and dad's chromosomes and then randomly separating them in such a way that you govern diploid to haploid number of chromosomes. Then it involves randomization with respect to mom and dad's chromosomes about which one makes it into which sperm or which egg. All of that stuff, which presumably has evolved because sex is a good search procedure on, and this is another topic, relevant fitness landscapes. And the question is where do the good fitness landscapes come from? But anyway, let's just take that, the part that I just said. So we have Mendel's laws, and we do have Mendel's laws. But they are an emergent property of the emergent thing called life that has evolved into a biosphere that we could not pre-state, that it's come into existence and now, in fact, governs the behavior of the bulk of the biosphere. So, here we do seem to have time-varying laws. I think it's probably unassailable that we have time-varying law-like somethings, if we're willing to say that Mendelian laws are laws. And we can't say it ahead of time. Now, we might cavil about whether or not Mendel's laws are what we would want to call laws. And what we have in mind when we say that is, but in physics we have real laws. And in biology, there are no real laws. There's just these contingent unfoldings that give rise to regularities that govern the way the biosphere continues to evolve. It's not clear that that move is a legitimate move.
Okay. That which move is a legitimate move?
Well, when we say that biology fails to have real laws, that Mendel's law isn't a real law, I don't know what the status of that is. It seems to have merit because we have in mind Newton's laws or something like that, okay, which are good for all time and all space and so on and so forth. So we think that the distinction is a firm one, but it's not so clear that it's a firm one, and that's exactly what we're talking about right now. So it's of interest, I guess I'll say in closing, to take the biological case as a case in point to wonder whether or not similar problems arise at the physical level. They certainly arise at the social level.
Well, so I have just a question of intellectual fact. You take this view of the absence of the view that it is impossible prospectively to state the boundaries of the possible states of affairs.
Right.
I take that to be an intrinsic feature of the historical character of natural history.
Yes.
Always.
Right.
And it was traditionally viewed as a manifestation of the explanatory weakness of natural historical thinking,
right,
taking as the model of strong explanation
physics,
Newtonian mechanics.
Right.
But of course, on its face, it seems to be just a prejudice. There's no a priori reason to think that, that one is the supreme form of reason or explanation. Now, if one were to project this view,
which view?
Back, this view,
my view.
No, your view,
yeah,
the natural historical view,
mm-hmm,
freed from this prejudice that it is just a diluted form of something else, mm-hmm, and thinking of it instead as its own thing, and were then to project it back into physics, how much or in what way would its projection back into physics, and especially into cosmology, disturb the standard physical cosmological views today?
And can I just insert one thing, Roberto, before Lee answers your question with a definitive and clear answer, because I'm sure he will. That's why I was at pains to begin with the argument that biology is not reducible to physics, and not for a mysterious reason, but it's that the complete physical explanation of an organism doesn't pick out the functions of the parts. Okay, and that is precisely to say that it is not some watered-down version of a real thing called physics, that biology exists with emergent properties, and we have to deal with biology on its own level. And as a matter of fact, since an organism is nothing but a bag of molecules, okay, it is just a physical system. We have to lift physics up to biology. It's not the other way around. So anyway, back to Lee's response.
So one back to something that Stu said, just to clarify. So one feedback of that situation to physics, which we played with, which is very concrete, is a conjecture. Let me just state it, because I alluded to it before. The configuration space in Newtonian mechanics is very simple.
Can I say one other thing that I wanted to say, very brief? I started by saying that in Einstein, one has events, but events seem to be very simple things, like particles at places. What about a rabbit, okay? Somehow you can't get a rabbit with the functions of its parts, okay, into that story. And I think that's a deep point.
But, so one line of argument that you could take, however, is, which is, I think, the traditional reductionist line of argument, is that if you specify where in the configuration space you are, that is exactly where the gravitational field is, where all the molecules and atoms are, and so forth, and you have the laws, in principle, you quote just the Bao in some sense. And another thing I bracketed that we have to get back to is an issue that Lucien mentioned, which I know is also an issue for Fotini, which is the outside versus the inside perspective. You know, that is, we are helping ourselves when we talk about cosmology as if it were Newtonian physics to an outside perspective. We are also helping ourselves to the notion of infinite computability, which I hope we'll talk about when we get to computer science, is the limits of computability. That is, we're assuming that we're not just talking religious jargon with no meaning when we talk about things like knowing where all the atoms in the universe are and evolving, computing where they're going to be in the future, but helping ourselves with that. One could say it doesn't matter what rabbits are, you know, you just follow the evolution. Now, your point is that the evolution is strongly changed by the existence of rabbits, but it still doesn't defeat the reductionist claim that if you didn't care about rabbits, you could just follow the molecules. At least we should come back to that.
Yeah, I disagree with you, but we can come back to
that. Okay, I don't know whether I agree with what I said or not, but for other people, the issue that we try to make as a wedge in this is the following. In general relativity, maybe I'll just say this. In general relativity, the space of configurations in Newtonian mechanics, the space of configurations, assuming that there's a background space, is a space of coordinates of all the particles. And if it's in Euclidean space, we know what that space is. It's Euclidean space, which is usually called R, to the power of 3 times the number of particles, or if you want to specify also the velocities, 6 times the number of particles. Okay. In general relativity, the configuration space is not directly specified because there are equivalences. That is, there are, at the level of the coordinates that we use, the things that we are able to get our hands on in mathematics to describe a geometry, there are large sets of equivalent geometries. Part of this is the ability, this is not the same thing as, but it's related to the fact that you can use any coordinates you like to coordinatize space in general relativity. As a result, there are equivalents, big equivalences, in which the same geometry is specified different ways. So the equivalent space, the configuration space, is a quotient of something easy to specify. Okay, so something which we can easily specify, okay, with large equivalence sets, where the whole set of equivalent geometries described different ways become one point here. And the claim that you can make that operation is something which is unproven in the mathematics. So given that there are many things we know in mathematics where there are things which are non-provable or non-constructible, okay, we motivated a conjecture that perhaps the construction of the configuration space is unconstructible, very concretely in general relativity. And we can discuss why that is. And that's a kind of technical discussion, but the important thing is that even in general relativity, it's a possible conjecture and still open, that simply the step of constructing a configuration space is not doable, for a reason which is not unrelated to the reason why it's not doable in the biosphere or in other segments of life. I mean, we don't know whether that conjecture is true or not.
If I may make 2 comments. I mean, one is that, of course, one can introduce diffeomorphism covariance in Newtonian physics as well. And indeed, even if one doesn't do that, one can consider symmetries of Newtonian physics and quotient them out too. So I'm not clear to what extent this is a special consideration to general relativity. I'm prepared to believe that there are alternatives available, affine space formulations of Newtonian theory, which, as it were, bypass the problem. Okay, but a more, I think, significant point that I would like to make to what Stu has been saying is, even within physics, we have these problems of non-reducibility. So I think one's got to be rather sharper about what is special about the biology-physics divide. I mean, in physics... So I think we're all perhaps familiar. How do you go from quantum electrodynamics or QCD or some standard model, say, even to non-relativistic quantum mechanics, how do you do it? How do you go to condensed matter states? It's been a very long-standing debate over the last 15 or 20 years that condensed matter physics is autonomous, in the sense not derivative or grounded on more fundamental theory. So if there's something specific to biology vis-a-vis physics now, it is that the necessary concepts really are alien to physics. And this, again, feeds into a long tradition where the necessary concepts, for example, are teleological. Now, I don't know if you would take that view, I don't know that I would either, but so let us perhaps be worried a bit about what is so special about the biology-physics divide that isn't already present.
So I think that's a fine point. I mean, I argued it as a biologist because I am a biologist and I'm competent more or less to argue it as a biologist. I argued it for biology. I didn't actually say, and I don't know, but I'm glad to be informed, that the same kinds of problems arise in physics. So I didn't bring it up as a distinction between biology and physics. I do, in my third book, try to get at teleology, in the sense that I try to think of what is the simplest physical system to which we would be willing to apply teleological categories, and I call that a molecular autonomous agent. and I think it's a system that reproduces itself and does thermodynamic work cycles. But unabashedly, one brings in teleological explanation. And we do for ourselves, you know. And we do really say that, you know, we're eating cookies and we're going to go eat lunch, and we just went outside because God knows maybe there was a fire in the building or some poison in the building. And I think we can say it of a bacterium swimming up a glucose gradient. We say it's going to get food, okay? But we don't say it for a rock rolling down a hill. So, so I'm going to ascribe teleological language to some minimal thing. Okay, it starts somewhere, and it's not in rocks, and it is in organisms. So I do cross that divide, but I don't know what to say about it. I mean, having done it, you can make the weak form of it, so you're playing a Wittgensteinian language game, and that's at least true. Okay, but it may be stronger than that.
I have just a little backup to it, which is, mm-hmm. I mean, I think you made a very interesting claim, and I'm prepared to believe, and Roberto found it an interesting claim, I'm prepared to believe it's fundamental, that the real contrast is between those theories or quasi-theories which do admit a configuration space and those which do not. And if that's the crucial desideratum, then I'm prepared to believe this is something rather new that we do not see in physics, because what happens in physics as one goes from one level to another, typically one has a new construction for configuration space, which holds only within some domain, some regime, some approximation and so forth, but it is yet, in some sense, in the traditional style of physics. Now, actually, maybe that's a mistake. I'm not sure if it's true.
Well, that was the intention that I asked Lee, which was to restate it. Is there today a respectable physics or cosmology that dispenses with the idea of a closed configuration space?
No, but some of us, correct me if I'm wrong, have dreamed of making one.
But it's not yet there.
Yes, I think.
Okay. I worry whether condensed matter physicists would say we don't have configuration spaces in condensed matter physics. I worry about that.
I can certainly imagine.
So I wanted to say just too that all these three points that you made, they are, you made the same point, but they're all true in physics.
I'm glad to hear that.
They're completely, it's not the common understanding, but. It's sort of a growing understanding that this is true. This is just the case. So to continue with the solid state physicist. So if a solid state physicist looks at a bucket of water or something like that, and he can write down the Schrödinger equation governing that, but the point is he can't do anything with it, right? So in principle you can write down where the position of all the molecules are and what the forces between them are and stuff like that. And you can write it down, so there's a configuration space for this, and it's huge. But there's nothing you can do with it, right? So the point is that I give you that equation, I give you all that knowledge, and you would not know that there's water, ice, and gas for this moment. You don't know. So it's all fine. In principle, there's this big configuration space. But in practice, you cannot do that. You cannot make the step from this... This configuration space to the space of say ice or something.
And why? What is the nature of the obstacle?
The nature of the obstacle, well, in some sense it's computational. You can't.
It says strong interactions of many degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
Non-linear interactions of many degrees of freedom.
But the nature of the obstacle is simply the multiplicity of causal connections,
yeah.
Or something
mm-hmm.
more
mm-hmm.
fundamental
yeah.
beyond
mm-hmm.
that.
No, it's that. It's that. And that's, I mean, so you made this one statement, which was, what was your statement? That evolution is too narrow to accommodate real novelty. And I think...
No, that the idea of evolutionary emergence that Stuart mentioned in his initial statement seemed too narrow to accommodate a radical idea of innovation.
Yeah, I think that is not... True. So I think that you can really have novelty emerging. Stuff that you write something down and the point is you don't know what's in there. You just don't know.
I think Robert is next. Yes, I think from the point of view of a conservative cosmologist who would like to work with a fixed configuration space, in terms of, so I would try to take it all the way as far back as I can, in terms of following observations, that I get into trouble. The Big Bang, what you call this initial condition hypersurface, that's the trouble. So I do not, so I guess trying to follow the conservative approach, I see the boundary.
I have a couple of comments. One is the way that I see the difference between biological and physical systems, I think is what Stuart was saying. I'll just put another word on it, which is that you had adaptation. You have adaptive elements in the system, which is not something that we normally deal with in physics. I'm not saying you cannot make a physical theory for these things, but the dynamical laws that you need to consider and the phase spaces that you need to consider are then much more complicated and complex and so on. So this is one thing. So it's the thing is that the basic elements that you have somehow change their behavior for some reasons, depending on what's going on around them in their own internal states. Okay, and then you need to have a model of that, and that seems complicated. Okay, the second thing is that the question was asked about what happens in condensed matter physics, and there, I think it's fair to say that there isn't any theory, at least not one that I've ever seen, that where you do not know what your configuration space is that you start out with. Okay, you just have phase space, you know, and that's and the problem is that it is an infinite, I'll use the word a little bit loosely, an infinite dimensional phase space. For which it would take you an infinite amount of time to specify completely the state of the system, okay? And furthermore, that's not what you're interested in. So biology has this way that we can look at it as an information-reduced way, that we don't, what we see are distinct objects. Even if we look, you know, out in space, we see stars, we see identifiable objects, even though presumably these equations that govern the formation of these things are continuous. So we can still talk about discrete things. And it's not at all clear sort of how to do that from a highly nonlinear theory, even in relatively simple cases where you don't have adaptation per se. So that it seems like there's a whole bunch of issues that are getting thrown in at the same time. Mm-hmm. I wanted to try to pull them apart. I don't know how much is really special to biology that we don't already have an inkling for in ordinary physical systems, that we have a hard time dealing with strongly nonlinear systems where we see, you know, emergent collective behavior, where we see discrete entities coming out of continuous equations. So that's it.
Yeah. Lee?
Okay, Stu?
I just wanted to ask Roberto, I want to gently disagree with you, and then you can put me down.
Mm-hmm.
When Jaron becomes famous, and there's lots of little Jarons and Jaronettes running around with earthquake detectors that have never existed before in the history of the universe, that looks pretty novel to me. And so are you persuaded on reflection that you can't get real novelty out of biological evolution?
Depends how much. So I guess a thought experiment would be to take a strong conception of novelty in the historical realm, in the social realm, and describe in the following way, by this metaphysical thesis. The thesis is, we humans always act within a framework of institutional arrangements and ideological or conceptual assumptions that govern most of what we do. So to a large extent, we act as if we were the puppets of these frameworks. And we naturalize them. We treat them as if they were the way things have to be.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, they're not the way things have to be. And in fact, there's always more in us than there is in them. So there is no framework and no list of frameworks that we can enumerate prospectively that exhausts our powers. And none of these frameworks can ever, in fact, completely reduce us to the condition of puppets. Mm-hmm. So we can always see more and do more and associate more than any of them or any combination of them can accommodate. Mm-hmm. And thus we can subvert them and reinvent them.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say one thing to what you're saying. By the way, okay,
yeah.
You're using agent language.
Yes.
Okay. And the whole point about teleology is that I've been struggling with, Roberto.
Yes.
Where does agency come from in the universe? Okay. So, but I agree with you in the social realm.
Yes.
Because bacteria presumably don't have social norms.
So metaphysically or theologically, we would say the frameworks, the orders, the contexts with respect to us are finite, and we with respect to them are infinite. Because we spill over. There is a residue of subversive possibility. That allows for the possibility of what I'm calling strong novelty or strong innovation. A weaker form of innovation is the conventional conception of natural history, in which functional explanation operates, but it operates with the material that happens to be there, as in your example of the X adaptations and the many loosely connected causal sequences, so that there is a residue of brute facticity in the situation.
Yep.
That seems to be a weaker sense of novelty. It is a sense of novelty, but it is weaker than the other sense.
Yeah.
So then, if we go back now to the physical or cosmological realm, One level of projection backward from one realm to the other would be to project back into the physical and the cosmological this specific relative sense of novelty of biological functional explanation with its element of brute facticity. Now, brute facticity certainly exists even in the standard cosmological model because of the notion of the factitious element in the initial conditions of the so-called Big Bang. But then one could even think of the way in which the stronger sense of innovation would have counterparts in the biological realm and in the physical and cosmological realm. So it's not that I'm denying that there's innovation, it's just that it's less radical, a less radical sense of novelty than the one that I'm attributing to the social realm. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking, how far can it be projected back?
Mm-hmm.
Or how alien is it to our present ways of biological and cosmological thinking?
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to, I don't know if it would be different or variant on what Roberto said, because one way, a more liberal version of social constructs is that, in fact, the more constraints, the more room for agency, because the liberal kind of Tocquevillian notions of society is that all of these constraints are exactly there as laws to reduce the complexity that Maya was talking about and Olaf, and that the whole game is about reducing enough of the noise complexity, as it were, in society, so that just like a dam, you can channel liberty and agency to what really, really matters. So in fact, it's the frameworks. It's not a residue as in a more liberal vision.
No, of course.
Freedom
of course.
And agencies are not a residue or a spillover. Just like in a dam, the energy of the water is not that it spills over. It's exactly that it is channeled and constrained. And that's where the freedom goes. And in fact, the more structured and simplified these frameworks are, the more there is this room.
No, fine. So
novelty.
Order has to exist as an enabling condition, even for subversion, for creative freedom. That's granted. But now take this idea in social and political theory, the institutional form of a free society. So is it true that a free society has a single, natural, and necessary institutional form? Is it the case, for example, that the market economy, taking that as the idea of a free economic order, can be translated into a single set of legal and institutional arrangements. Now, I deny that. That in fact, there is no uncontroversial translation of the abstract idea of democracy or of a market or of a free civil society into any particular set of institutional arrangements. And thus, it is essential in a free society that there be an active contest over the institutional form of what a free society is, and the possibility of doing things that involve the transformation of the framework as well as move within the framework. And that gets us back to this radical sense of innovation. And under a free society, there is not a perpetual motion machine that organizes freedom forever. There is a contest over the form of the free society itself. Mm-hmm. And that's this problem of subversion. Now, what's the counterpart to that in the biological realm? The question I was asking.
Don't know. Because what you're appealing to, and I think correctly, is a radical freedom of agent tribal action. Right? We don't have to sit around the table and have lunch together. One of us could jump out of the window with a parachute and land on the ground and eat bananas. I mean, who knows, right? So there is, once you have agency, once you have agency and I guess norms, you need something like norms. And presumably, bacteria don't do this, although ants might. We have freedom with respect to those norms and can, if we wish, and have courage, deviate from them. I think that that's another emergent level. I think you're probably right with that, though.
Let me interrupt for a moment since I have the duty as a moderator. We're at 1 o'clock, which was scheduled for lunch, so we should make a decision whether we'd like to proceed now or break for lunch. That's the first question.
So, just a point of information, I just postponed lunch 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
So I thought that would be how long it took us.
Okay, so let's we'll conclude the biology discussion in 10 minutes, and after lunch we'll start with computer science. Okay.
Okay. That is why we're doing that. I would propose, just so people can get their thoughts prepared, that after we do computer science, we proceed to time.
Good.
Okay.
Okay.
So, may I make an observation that I don't want to deflate this particular conversation, but it may be that the parallels are simpler than appear. It may be that the right parallel to the institutional framework, which is, as it were, overcome, which is transcended, and so forth, is the species. It may be that already biology is exhibits the features that you see in social science at the level simple evolution, so spontaneous mutation and a mechanism of selection and so forth. And that it may be that the biochemistry underlying that is what transcends the species as a set of species, as some sort of immutable, unchanging institutions, as it were, of life. But these are broken down, and repeatedly broken down, because after all, we're at an effective level where the laws admit exceptions, and so forth. So there may be a rather simpler relationship between social science and biology than we've been observing.
Let me raise a question with respect to this. So there's a notion that Stu introduced to deal with the lack of a configuration space, which, if you don't mind, I'll mention, which is the adjacent possible. So this is the conjecture that if you can't describe the whole configuration space, maybe you can learn enough about where you are now to discuss what are the options for the next step. And I should say I'm not completely convinced that this will always work in biology, but
I don't think it will. I mean, if it did work, you could say what the you could say what the Darwinian pre-adaptations are, and that's just what it seems to be with campus. Is some of the adjacent possible we know about, and some of it we don't have the damnedest idea about. Even though I'm fond of the idea of the adjacent possible.
Okay. Well, so sorry.
I just wanted to go back to Simon's question because just to be sure we see if we agree or disagree. So. A homely kind of accident or novelty in natural history would be like saying certain features developed in, say, in the mammalian population rather than the marsupial population just because of the accidents of plate tectonics, because the marsupials happened to be isolated and the mammalians were not, the mammals were not, and thus subject to richer forms of competition. And it's an accident because these characteristics could have developed in the placental population if the relation of these two families of animals to the continental plates had been different. So we say that's an accident. But from a larger standpoint, it's no exemption to causal explanation. It's just that the causal links are multiple, complicated, and loose. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is that the kind of surprise or complication that's also involved even in the formation of the higher order regularities described, for example, by Mendel's laws? So it's just a fancier version of the same kind of thing that happens in this example of the mammals and the marsupials. Now, that's different from the idea in society and history of subversive and reconstructive projects which are founded on this fact that there's more in us than there is in the institutional and ideological structures that we create and inhabit.
See, Roberto, let me say that you've got to be right. And it's in your language. You cannot state the notion of subversive without having the notion of norms. It's part of that language.
And the idea of project, which is an idea of intentional action, and
right.
That's of consciousness.
Correct. But you need all of that stuff, which is
yes.
Not there, which is not there for bacteria, right?
Yes.
Surely what this is missing, there are two kinds of things we can be doing. One is to take the substance of the notion of what is freedom, what is intentionality, and what are norms. And one can then ask, in biology, do we see these concrete notions, do they play a role, are they available? But the other question is rather, as a scientific or quasi-scientific discipline, do we see similar methodologies or very different methodologies, do we see similarities in our problem situations or not? And it's rather in the latter sense that the parallels may be closer to the surface. By focusing rather on questions of substance, do we have norms in biology? And then, of course, the answer becomes, well, not really, or not unless we're talking about sort of rather high-order life forms and so forth, not bacteria, but possibly in the insect world, and so on. That seems to me a less interesting debate if we're truly to make links between, say, physics questions in cosmology, biology, social science. Should we not be looking at as it were, a common problematic, not so much whether very explicit notions translate in from one field to another, but whether we have, and to give the example, do we have a pre-existing configuration space or not? You know, that's the level at which to analyze the parallels and where we can fruitfully...
Yes, I hadn't understood the sense here of this change between us as suggesting that there is no closed configuration space in either biology or history, but the sense in which there is not is different.
Well, if you trace that sense to notions like intentionality, well, actually intentionality maybe figures... If you're going to trace that notion to say, the existence of norms or their absence, then the answer will be different and trivially different.
Yeah.
But surely that's not such an interesting...
It's not such an interesting... I agree, and that wasn't my impulse. My impulse was to ask whether the way of thinking about transformation is different, because from your intervention back, it seemed that the problem of the closed configuration space was really based on an idea of unmasterable complication or looseness of the causal sequences,
okay,
as opposed to the idea of conscious innovation in which the order of the presuppositions is reshaped.
I'd like to inject a comment myself. I've been trying to be different since I'm the moderator. But if I could, I just want to make one comment, which is from a computer scientist's perspective, the difference between biology and physics is that biological processes contain representations, and so there's a communication from the genotype to the phenotype and back to the genotype. And what's interesting about that is somehow, even though we don't know what it is, embedded within that is a scheme that has a sense of smoothness or similarity from one configuration to the next. So in other words, if the genotype changes incrementally, the change in the phenotype is also incremental enough that there's some signal in the noise of the evolutionary process so that it can proceed. So there's some representation that creates that opportunity for signal that is not yet known, which seems to me to be the great mystery of biology. And physics, as it's been construed, involves systems that have a kind of a perfection to them, if you like, rather than dealing with this notion of similarity of form, the sort of looseness of fit. There's either completely stochastic representations or perfect representations, but the notion of similarity is demonstrably existent in biology, though it isn't described yet. And that seems to me to be, perhaps there'll be some physics of the future that's also like that, but anyway, no physics I've seen has ever had that quality. This relates a little bit to what I'll say in the presentation on computer science, but I want to caution against what I see as a fallacy here. On the table in the sciences, there is so far only one class of explanation for what we might call the creation of deep novelty, or what we might call creativity or invention or something, and that is the various versions of neo-Darwinism as a family. It's possible that there are other classes. There might be something going on in the human brain, for instance, that is not neo-Darwinistic and yet is also capable of the creation of extreme novelty and might even be describable and described someday. That's at least a possibility, which I'd like to hold out for various reasons. I would like to not discount that. So I think in the order that it was Robert and Maya and Mishdeet.
Yes, why don't we then close on the room.
Okay.
Everybody who had their hand up, Mishdeet, and then we...
Okay.
Yeah, so I just want to make a comment to the issue of closed phase space or open mm-hmm. phase space. I think that's important to time, to the issue of time. So, mm-hmm. And I think this is where cosmology, physics and cosmology, or let's say cosmology brings a new element to physics. So if you want to do quantum theory in cosmology, I think you are inevitably forced to the conclusion that the configuration space cannot be time independent. And to make that argument, let me just take the cosmological framework that we have in observation, that we've confirmed in observations, that the universe is expanding. I'll couple that with the idea of a fundamental length. Then you find that inevitably the configuration space has to have been growing, because more and more lengths which we now observe have fallen below the cutoff length as we go back in time. So in a quantum theory of cosmology, we are faced with the need of having a time-dependent configuration space.
Yeah,
and to me, that just creates huge problems.
Right.
I don't know how to deal with it.
I just very briefly will say that I disagree with you. I think that representation is an emergent phenomena that one can describe in the language of physics. It's just more complicated in the case of biology.
I don't want to get into a big argument right now.
I want to eat, actually. But I just wanted to say for the record.
We'll address that in the next.
I disagree with that.
Okay.